From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's show, I speak with Tracy Ullman. She's an English actress, comedian, and recording star who's now displaying her talents on American television in her own comedy variety series on the Fox Broadcasting Network. Also today, I talk with author H.F. Saint. In his new novel, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, a normal New York businessman is transformed by a scientific accident. Jazz critic Francis Davis looks at the life and music of vocalist Big Joe Turner, and guest television critic David Mark tells us why in the world of sitcoms, everything old is new again. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Tracy Ullman. She's a singer, dancer, actress, comedian, and currently the star of her own television show on the Fox Broadcasting Network. Tracy Ullman now lives in Los Angeles, but she grew up in London, or just outside of London, and began her career as a dancer on British television variety shows. She went on to appear in West End musicals, playing Frenchie in Grease and Janet in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. In 1981, Tracy Ullman won the London Theatre Critics' Most Promising Actress Award for her performance as Beverly, a bizarre nightclub singer in a mostly improvisational play called Four in a Million at the Royal Court Theatre. She roller skated in a workshop production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Starlight Express, but she turned down the chance to go with the show to London's West End and instead made her film debut in Paul McCartney's Give My Regards to Broad Street. Tracy Ullman then earned the critics' praise for her appearance alongside Meryl Streep in the movie Plenty. Tracy Ullman has also had 10 singles in the British pop charts. Her song You Broke My Heart in 17 Places went gold. British television viewers have seen Tracy Ullman on several very funny shows, Three of a Kind, A Kick Up the 80s, and Girls on Top. And her new half-hour character comedy variety series on American television, The Tracy Ullman Show, has just been renewed for a second season by the Fox Broadcasting Network. Tracy Ullman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello. And a right little clever dick she is. What a little clever clog she is. God, what else do I do?
That's it. It doesn't seem like there's much left.
What's your favorite recipe? Do you have knitting patterns you can talk about?
How did you get started in this business?
How did you get started in this business?
Listen, are you surprised at all by the success of this Tracy Ullman show? I mean, the second season on American TV.
Well, it's... I hope it's a success. I really don't know. You get sort of conflicting reports. And it's nice. I've just been to England for a month, and it was great because I came back, and instead of like the normal, okay, why are you trying to bring into the country and maybe a strip search, it was like, hello, how's your show? It's so funny. You could talk about me on your show. I just doing my best and hoping it's catching on, and I don't know. Is it catching on? I hope so.
You've been getting some interesting reviews. I mean, there was a big review in, Vanity Fair. You were described as someone who has a brain that races across the radio dial and a voice that broadcasts in stereo. And I think, actually, that's a compliment.
That's nice. I remember someone described me once as Minnie Mouse on methadone for one of my records. And I sang like, I can't break away, now you make me fast. So, yes, it's good. It's a good response.
How'd you get the show? Did someone sort of grab you and say, Tracy, we're going to make you a star?
I really wanted to do something on American television, and it's tough. It's the same as in England. There's really 2% of the business here, the business love, there is any great quality. And I decided that I wanted to do television or films with Jim Brooks or Woody Allen. I made a list. There's two people on it. There you go. So Woody wouldn't keep me out of his bloody movies. I'm saying, now listen here, Woody. So he wouldn't have me in his movies. So I got taken under Jim Brooks's wing, which is a very good wing to be taken under because he's done so much, so many wonderful shows, especially for women, like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda. And then he did Taxi and, of course, his wonderful film, Terms of Endearment.
And all that. Not too shabby.
Very powerful women in that.
Yeah.
And he has a great love and enthusiasm for things that he's never lost. He's not like one of those elusive Hollywood producers now who's so successful you can't ever talk to him. He still has a great enthusiasm for things. And so he wanted to do a show and... we didn't want to do a situation comedy because I'd been through all that whole thing of like all the the networks, it seemed, wanted was a really nice show where Tracy's a British nanny and she solves problems and she helps cute kids and maybe she has a sidekick, you know, and it was just all care and share, mush and that. So we decided to do a variety show because there hasn't been many variety shows done recently, have they? I mean, it seemed like they got to the point where it was always like, it was like, you know, it's Shirley like Bassey on a speedboat on the Everglades in a fur coat singing Goldfinger. And then it was Luciano Pavarotti and a few fountains and a few girls in Atlantic City. Yeah. And so, you know, it was good to do a variety show again.
It's been described as a skit-com because you've got several running characters in there and you've also got blackout sketches. Mm-hmm. But it's not just sort of funny ha-ha. There's a lot of characters that are done that are a little bit meatier than that. There's, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, a message going on, something
yes,
a little deeper.
Yes, because, and in the show, we don't do parodies of other television shows or, you know, laugh at commercials or soap operas or anything. And that's a conscious decision because that always dates a show. We're trying to make timeless television, you know. Yes, I mean, the show doesn't necessarily have to be funny ha-ha all the time, exactly, you know. It's just to try and get a bit of depth, a bit of meaning, a bit of reality to things, which there doesn't seem to be a lot of on television, does it really?
One sketch.
But don't worry, I'm not doing like a workshop by myself. I'm one of serious people.
One sketch that sticks in my mind is when you did about a very elderly, fading actress who's been signed to do a commercial.
Oh, yeah.
And she goes through this whole method, and you really have this empathy for her. Is she going to make it? And by the end of it, she's got this standing ovation, and the tears are coming down the eyes. You know,
that was prompted, funny enough, by Barbara, what's this called, Bell Geddes, the Dallas lady that does that soup commercial. And it's so sincere. And they look at the camera, and hearty, thick, warm broth for my husband because I love him. And it's like that sincerity with older people. They put them in a nice sort of like pale blue turtleneck. And they, it's good to do that.
You do an impeccable American accent.
I'm like a parrot. I pick up accents. I love accents. I was always interested in doing all British accents. If I couldn't do an accent, I used to like find a show that would take me to that place so I could live there. Like in England, there's this industrial northern town called Newcastle. No one would ever want to go there, but I wanted to go there so I could learn the accent, you know. And I love accents. I've lived here for 3 years, really, on and off, so you do learn to pick up the accents.
Is it true that you went to malls and taped people talking?
Yeah, I do. I was always listening to people, just listening to people in the... I mean, the great thing about not being known here is I'm, you know, so anonymous. I just stand around in shops and listen to accents. Whereas in England, it got to the point where if I tried to listen to someone in a shop, they get completely paranoid. Oh, you're going to copy me. She's going to do my voice. Oh, look at her. So I'm like, weirdo. So it's been... but I get all the girls on the show, anyone I meet, I just say, if they have an interesting voice, I say, would you tape it for me? And so they go, oh, yeah. The funniest thing is listen to them on the tapes and they go, oh, hi, I'm reading from a book. I feel really stupid. What do I talk about? Okay, I'll read from a book and then you can listen to my accent. I feel really stupid. And it's them saying things like that that you get the accent from.
That
you
know. Sounds like Francesca, your 14-year-old character.
Oh, yes, Francesca. She's based on a neighbour of mine. But, oh, God, I better not say it's my neighbour. Well, I've said it now. And I wanted to do somebody with having a painful adolescence. I was lucky. I didn't have a very painful adolescence. My sister did. She had to stand behind my mother's back and talk through my mother for 3 years. She was so shy.
Was she older or younger than
she's
you?
Also covering the acne, you know. She had such a painful adolescence. She's older. And so I wanted to play a young girl with the braces on the teeth and the... You know, that because I always had one of those mothers that would go, if you're worried about the size of your breasts, then tell the doctor. Mom, don't say this. It's like so embarrassing, you know, that sort of thing. What do you mean your breasts aren't big enough? Tell the doctor. My mom was one of those mom.
But Francesca doesn't have a mother in this sketch. She lives with
that's
her father
true.
And her father's lover.
Yes, that's what makes such an interesting continuing character. We must find out whatever happened to her mother because Francesca's father is gay and he lives with his lover, William. So she goes, this is my dad and this is my William. And she's a nice kid, actually, Francesca. She's come out as a really sort of nice kid.
Another running character you have on the show is Kay.
Oh, yes, Kay.
She's a secretary in an office, and she's the kind of person that wears polyester cardigans.
Yeah, you know the nice... There's probably one in this office that they sell the girls sanitary napkins and stamps. You know, those sort of nice ladies that... They'll never get married. They turn up on their little motorcycles every day, and they come in wearing a little motorcycle head. Oh, my golly gosh, that freeway was busy today, and it got blown off twice. And they're just those sweet people. They'll never, you know, they have these... And then she has a very sick mother at home, but her mother's not 64 years old and moaning. She'll never ever let Kay leave home, and so she has to phone her mother all the time, and she goes, "Hello, Mummy, it's Kay." And you can just imagine her mother, "Kay, I feel terrible, I've been sitting here all morning." And they just devote their lives to their parent. Yeah. I used to talk to a lady in a bank in England that sounded just like that, and that's how I based the character. She would say things like, I spoke to her from Hollywood. She'd go, "Hello, Miss Ullman. How's Hollywood? You didn't see Bette Davis today, did you? Oh, I love those movies. They're marvellous, those people, aren't they? But there you go. All the glitter and razzle. How can I help you?" You know anything.
When you're working with the writers. Yeah. When you're working with the writers on the show, you've got people like Heidi Perlman from Cheers and Ken Esten from Taxi. And when you were working on shows in London, you also had a good core of people that you were working with, people like Ben Elton as a writer and yeah. Actresses like Jennifer Saunders and Dawn French and Ruby Wax and the great late Joan Greenwood.
Joan Greenwood, yes.
Whom you worked on. Is there a kind of improvisational portion of the creative process when you're creating this sort of TV show? Do you sort of throw everything out there and then start drawing back, filtering out what's good, what can stay, what works, what doesn't?
Just these shows just take a lot of energy, enthusiasm, and lots of ideas all the time. I mean, just Julie Kavner, the actress in the show with me, is wonderful because you talk all the time. If you get on with people, you have a laugh, you have a good time, and you try out voices and situations, and then you can suggest stuff, and it works. It's a very hard show to do, doing a variety show, because we haven't got our situation comedy set, you know, our stairway and our sofa, and so therefore, you know, you have to think of stuff every week, and no one's got used to doing this show because we don't have the same set every week, we don't have the same characters, so you have to bounce off each other all the time to think of new things. Julie's great. I mean, people may, obviously, she's one of your wonderful TV people, Brenda Morgenstern in Rhoda.
Right. But she's never.
I love her voice. And just by being Julie Kavner, you know how Julie Kavner talks? Julie was in London recently. It's like Tracy, Trafalgar Square. It's amazing, man. The lions are so big. Meow. I just couldn't believe it. You know, it's crazy. And for me, liking her and doing her voice so much, we wrote a sketch where I became Julie. You know, and it's just by, you know, communicating and caring and sharing with each other so much that you think of ideas.
You have some characters that I have heard are based on experiences that you've had. You played this very hot kind of Latino dancer who was sort of in... There's a show in England called the Come Dancing show. Where
don't you just miss it?
Oh, very much, very much. Where they had the Latin finals.
Dun, dun, dun. She's sewn all the sequins on herself, and here comes Betty. She's a hairdresser with her own mobile van. And here comes Derek. He's a trainee ambulance man. They're always trainee ambulance man. And he makes all his own suits.
Well, you came
Seems
out...
Seems like a nice boy.
You came out and did the sketch about this Latin dancer who had forgotten a vital piece of her clothing.
Yeah, that happened to me. I was a dancer, and I went on stage once. I didn't have any underpants on, and it's always been a horror story that I've recounted to people, and I recounted it to the writers, and they wrote a piece about it, and so we sort of hammed it up a lot, I suppose, in the action. But it was true. I remember coming in from the beach. I was a dancer in one of those awful summer shows in England. It was like raining outside. I came in, and I forgot to put my top pants on. I went on stage and I'm dancing through this routine. It was like the old da 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 horrible music. And I just realized I thought, I feel so light and airy and I had no pants on. So I had to try and tell my male dance partner, who was about to throw me up in the air upside down, that I had no underpants on. And I was going, "I've got no panties on, don't throw me in the air."
Did he?
So, yes, he did. And the first few rows sort of. But it was shock. But so it eventually, you know, ends up on the as a piece.
Hysterical. My guest is Tracy Ullman. She's a singer, an actress, comedian. She currently has her own show on the Fox Broadcasting Network. And you have to perform almost on different levels, or you have throughout your career. Now you tape before a live audience. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
As well as do a monologue.
We film before. We've got. It's a four-camera film show, which gives it a lovely quality.
Mm-hmm. And then you do your monologue at the end, where you come out and actually are yourself in front of an audience. Are you comfortable doing that?
I wasn't at first because I have never been, and I don't think I could ever be, because it's such a scary thing to do, a stand-up comedian. I can't, you know, I find that I didn't want to ever come out and start falling into that sort of phraseology where they start going, ah, hi, girls. Is it, like, really hard to find a guy in this town, or is it just me? You know, that sort of, like, stand-up comic type stuff. And the airways, they're just the worst. Let me tell you about I lost my luggage, you know, that sort of stuff. I thought, God, I can't come out and do that because I've never done that. And so if we made stuff up, for me to say as myself, it would seem like a stand-up routine, and I can't talk about stuff that didn't really happen.
But those segments are written by someone. I see the credits at the end.
Yes, some of them. Well, it's really just I go out there sometimes. I just talk about anything, just something that happened today, or just.
I remember a touching monologue about your husband's golf clothes.
Yeah, well, that's true. My husband's golf, you know, yeah, Mr. Polyester himself. No, golfers wear horrible stuff. They're the over-logoed crowd. No, he wears, like, polyester mixed up. No, my husband wears horrible stuff. It's called Cashmelon. He's got these, like, these sweaters, and they're not cashmere, and they're not Orlon, so they're Cashmelon.
They're horrible. They're pink Madras, right? Pink plaid or lime green plaid.
Oh, yeah,
plaid
he wears all that
sort of stuff, yeah. My guest is Tracy Ullman. She is a singer, a dancer. We've talked about her acting, her being very funny, and starring in her own television show on the Fox Broadcasting Network. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tracy Ullman is my guest on Fresh Air, and we've talked a lot now about your television show and about your comedy, and we haven't really spoken that much about your career as a singer. I mean, after all, 10 singles on the British pop charts is pretty good, I should think. And in order to give everybody just a bit of a taste of the kind of things that you actually do in your own records and the kind of things you parody on The Tracy Ullman Show, we're going to play a little song called Move Over, Darling.
Our lips shouldn't touch.
Move over, darling.
I like it too much.
Move over, darling.
That gleam in your eye is no big surprise anymore. 'Cause you fooled me.
Give in,
and though it's not right, I'm too weak to fight it, so
That's Tracy Ullman. Move Over, Darling. She's my guest on Fresh Air. You said that's a long time ago you recorded that song.
Yeah, that was my singing career.
I imagine you in white go-go boots and sort of going down Carnaby Street.
I used to do all that stuff because there was just a time I was doing my own, with two other guys, a comedy show, and because I sang a lot, and they said, oh, let's make some records. So I thought, why not the old Midas touch at the moment? And it was... I didn't really belong in the recording world, but I did it sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it wasn't stupid. I mean, songs were sort of semi-serious, but I treated it with a lot of humour. And I used to do videos, with big platform boots on and,
you did a video,
the white go-go boots running down Carnaby Street. And I took a 60s theme to it all because my favourite singers had been 60s singers, Dusty Springfield, Sandy Shaw, Lulu, all those type of people, Brenda Lee. Mm-hmm. But as I say, it was semi-serious because everyone knows you're miming when you go on these, solid gold type shows. I used to sing into a hairbrush,
No.
What's the point of giving you a microphone? You know they're not singing for real. You know they're not. And I used to sing into a hairbrush. People felt a bit odd, but...
Did you do that when you were a child?
Yeah.
As well? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you used to do.
I think
in front
all
of the
did.
Mirror. Yeah, of course you did. You see, but you're...
Ben roll on,
yes. It looked like a microphone. And don't get too close, you might get it on your lips, and it tastes horrible.
No, I kept the cap on. I kept the cap on, doing Petula Clark songs and that sort of thing. You do a lot of pop songs in the Tracy Ullman show. Are they easier to parody? I mean, you could sing the song straight, but put it in a context that's totally removed from what the song is actually saying. One I remember that you're doing, I'm Different. You were sort of an elderly lady trying out for a heavy metal band.
Oh, yeah. I was like a Christy Minstrel type, the type that usually sing...
Up with
memory,
people.
I must live for the daylight, enunciate your words. One of those back of the stalls type singers, like a Broadway show type person. And, auditioned for a heavy metal band. And it could have become preposterous, that, but... If you believe enough in your characters and all that, it doesn't become preposterous. That has been a hard way to put the songs, because we don't want to just and here's Tracy Ullman singing her Flogging to Death, her new hit single, so you'll go out and buy it and make lots of money for her. So we tried, using songs in the context of suddenly in a sketch, the character would start to sing. And sometimes it can work. It worked very well on a piece we did of a girl, a Broadway actress who just had never got a job, and she was trying to kill herself by jumping off a ledge. She was going to finally make a big splash on Broadway. And then a policeman arrives who is called the jumper specialist, and he takes off his coat and he goes on the ledge with her and he dances and sings with her, makes her not want to kill herself. And that worked. But
the song that you did with that was...
If She Knew What She Wants, the Bangles song.
Right.
And I was sort of being thrown all over the place, and that was great because I got to do a bit of dancing there too.
But you have been taken seriously in the pop world. I mean, after all, you had Neil Kinnock, the Labour leader, in one of your videos.
That's true, yes. It was like having Walter Mondale. That's the equivalent here. Sounds exciting, huh? In your video.
I'm not sure any of our politicians would do something like that.
I know. That's what was... He got a hell of a pounding for it in the press, and so did I. But
really,
I don't know. I mean, it endeared him to the younger voters.
Yeah. Do you think, having done comedy over in England and now doing it here, are there limits to the satire that you can do? The censorship is different over there than it is here. I think you can get away with a lot more.
But yes, I think so. I think that but they've almost gone too far there because there isn't much censorship. I mean, Monty Python was funny. When you think about it, in 1972, when Monty Python was happening, people were like playing the piano and having their hands cut off and blood going everywhere. Silly, all that Monty Python stuff. And that was good, but it didn't leave people much room to go anywhere. And it's almost like comedy in England has gone too far now and too anarchic. And because they say, four-letter words on the TV sometimes, they've nowhere left to go. Here it is more restrained, and you do laugh at yourselves here, but it takes you more time, and it's a less cynical, pessimistic view of the world everyone seems to have here. So it can get a bit too ridiculous in England.
Yeah. Was it a risk for you to come here? I mean, after all, the Pythons were very popular. Benny Hill was very popular. But Rowan Atkinson...
More girls having Velcro bikinis ripped off.
Rowan Atkinson came to do a one-man show in New York and bombed. Nobody liked him and didn't understand him. And here you are, a nice British girl coming over to make it in America.
I had a big help coming here initially because of the records and being on MTV for a week and they have nothing to lose, you know. It's like the Fox network that I'm with now. They've got nothing to lose, really. It's a brand new network. They can take some chances. And I've been here a while. I've been here 3 years now. I studied Americans. I've watched a lot of TV. I mean, I was pregnant here. I still wander around the Beverly Center in stretch pants going, I look like a pudding, help me. And it took it all in. I mean, it's nothing worse than British people coming thinking they can just hop over the pond, lovey, and clean up dollars-wise. You've got to study it a bit here and then work out what makes the Americans tick a bit more.
You had to learn then to be an American?
Yeah, I used to sit at home when I was pregnant and watch reruns of all the old shows and get a bit of a grounding in
like
Americana.
What? Like which ones?
Jim Brooks used to give me tapes of your shows with Sid Caesar and Imogene Coker and Ernie Kovacs, and I watched all the I Love Lucy and all that, and all the Mary Tyler Moores again and The Odd Couple, and I mean, Leave It to Beaver. I mean, no, we never got that in England, so I just still watch Leave It to Beaver and The Gong Show and just everything, because you've got to get a grounding in everything, otherwise you don't know anything about it.
Right, and well, you'd done films as well. I mean, you were in Plenty, and Give My Regards to Broad Street. Did you ever mimic Meryl Streep?
Hi, sweetie. Hi, Peanut.
Is that
that's Meryl. Hi, Peanut.
Did you ever do it in front of her?
No. Well, she's a great gal. She's good to work with. She's a good laugh. She mimics. She's great. Mm. She can do any accent.
I read an interview with you where you had said that Plenty was sort of, just a bit of... not fluff wasn't the word, light relief.
Well, people were so kind about my performance, or so enthusiastic about it, but it was such a depressing movie for a lot of people. It was such a tough subject to deal with, a woman's very slow mental breakdown over 30 years. And, of course, every time I came on, I had something witty or maybe funny to say, and so people said, you were so funny in that movie. But I I'm not a great one at building my own self up, so I just said, it was a bit of light relief when I came on, you know.
Now with the new season, the second season of the Tracy Ullman Show, are there going to be any changes? Have you found some things that perhaps didn't work as well as you would like, or characters that you're going to be keeping?
Yeah, of course. That's the nature of the show. I mean, it's because it's a variety show, it's never the same any one week. So we have ideas all the time. It's forming. I mean, there are characters at work that will come back, but you know in your mind when they've lived their usefulness. And
who's
when
coming back? Is Tina coming back?
Oh, yeah, Tina and Meg are two... I've got to bring her back because I've got to perfect that accent.
The Postal Service, yes.
The Postal Service girls, they'll be back. Kay will be back, and Francesca, because we must find out whatever happened to Francesca's mother. Why did her father go gay? And we just try anything. That we're going to have the Kiki Howard-Smith back, the Australian golfer,
golfer.
I liked. I liked doing her because I love the Australian mentality. It's just so different from the American mentality.
In what way? What do you mean?
It's like girls, you know, they're a bit rough, you know, and you know, they don't get it, you know, that you're going to analysts and all things like that. No, it's all a bit weird, isn't it? And I like doing Australian because they're not all just bang a shrimp on the barbie for me, you know.
Is there room for anything else? I mean, you've got a daughter now, and any films more?
No, I mean, this show, I get to do everything I want to do. I'm really fulfilled at the moment. I get to sing, dance, act, be myself, you know, mess around. Mabel comes in, treats the set like a playground, starts throwing stuff around.
How old is she, two, three?
She's 16 months and has no respect for props at all. The prop women are so nice to her. Hi, honey, have a candy, you know. So she's going to be a Beverly Hills kid. Oh, no. Well, I don't have time for anything else, and I'm happy with this.
Right, and we don't have any more time either.
All right, then.
My guest has been Tracy Ullman, a well-known actress, singer, and comedian in her native England. She's now entertaining American television audiences in her new series on the Fox Broadcasting Network. The Tracy Ullman Show, by the way, has just received 4 Emmy Award nominations. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with attorney Martin Garbus. He's considered an expert on First Amendment issues in this country, but has also observed trials in South Africa, Chile, and the Soviet Union. These observations have been recorded in his new book, Traitors and Heroes. I hope you can join us.
You bet.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. Coming up, author H.F. Saint talks about his new novel, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, the story of an ordinary man who inadvertently becomes the guinea pig in an extraordinary scientific experiment. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a collection of songs from Big Joe Turner, the Kansas City bartender with the booming voice. And guest television critic David Mark examines the resurrection of 1950s sitcoms. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic, Francis Davis, has a review of a new album featuring some of the greatest hits by the late singer Big Joe Turner. Turner died in 1985, and Francis says since then, no one has been able to match him in either size or stature.
Baby. Love you, man. Well, all right. You got yourself a Cadillac car. Well, all right. You're hanging out in the finest bar. Well, all right. You're gonna get a little more.
I heard Big Joe Turner in person only once. It was at Tramps, a New York club, during the holiday season in 1981. The night didn't start off very well. Big Joe sat at the bar polishing off a roast beef sandwich and a fifth of whiskey while his backup group vamped its way through an interminable opening set. Always a big man, Turner had ballooned to gargantuan proportions. When he hobbled down the narrow aisle to the stage on his crutches, he almost toppled my chair with me in it. In a slurred voice, he told a long, pointless story about some Christmas cards he had forgotten to mail. When he finally began to sing, he was mic'd at such an ear-splitting level that one of my companions pleaded with the sound man to turn the volume down. Big Joe saw what was going on and didn't like it one bit. "Stop fooling with those dials, boy," he roared. "Leave that volume where it was." The intimidated sound man obeyed. If Big Joe was worried that his voice had lost some of its capacity, he had no reason to be. Amplification wasn't something he needed when he started out as a singing bartender in Kansas City in the 1920s, and it was superfluous that night at Tramps. Once he got down to business, his voice filled the room and then some. When he shouted, "Shake, rattle, and roll," the beer bottles and cocktail glasses on the tabletops vibrated as though they were going to. I had never heard anything like it, and I never expect to hear anything like it again. He looked like the whale that swallowed Jonah and sounded like Jonah bellowing to get out. It was awe-inspiring to imagine what it would have been like to have heard him 3 or 4 decades earlier, when he was in his prime. Nicknamed the Boss of the Blues, Turner straddled the worlds of jazz and pop like a colossus. In the early 1950s, he cracked the pop charts with a string of hits that helped to give shape to a nascent form of music later christened rock and roll. Atlantic Records has just released an album of Turner's greatest hits from that period. From it, we're going to hear What Else? Shake, Rattle, and Roll, recorded in 1953.
Pots and pans. Well, you wear old dresses, the sun comes shining through. dog. I said shake, rattle and roll. Shake, rattle and roll. Shake, rattle and roll. Shake, rattle and roll. Well, you won't do right to save your doggone soul.
From Big Joe Turner's greatest hits, Shake, Rattle, and Roll, a song that Bill Haley and the Comets later smothered in mayo and slapped between slices of white bread. Much as I love the music on this album, it doesn't represent Turner's best recorded work. In fact, it doesn't even represent his best work for Atlantic. That honor belongs to two albums from the late 1950s, which are currently out of print. One is The Boss of the Blues, the other is Big Joe Rides Again. Both feature Turner with jazz musicians of the caliber of Coleman Hawkins, Pete Johnson, and Lawrence Brown. By comparison, Shake, Rattle, and Roll, Chains of Love, Honey Hush, and the other tracks on Greatest Hits are kid stuff. But this music is historically important, and every track that Big Joe Turner ever recorded is to be cherished. Still, he was one of those performers you had to hear in person, and I feel sorry for the generations who won't have the chance. Turner died in 1985. There was never anyone else remotely like him, and there's no one to take his place. They don't make them that big anymore.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s, and writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Big Joe Turner's greatest hits. This is Fresh Air. My guest is H.F. Saint. 5 years ago, when he was 40, Saint abandoned his career as a real estate investor to write his first novel. It's called Memoirs of an Invisible Man. When he started taking the manuscript around to publishers, the first editor rejected it, advising him to take his fantasies to a psychiatrist. Saint took the book to another publisher instead and has since made more than $2.5 million from selling the rights to book clubs, foreign publishers, and the movies. Chevy Chase is signed to star in the movie version. When I spoke with H.F. Saint, I asked him to begin by reading a passage from the opening of Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
For the first 34 years of my life, I was exactly like everyone else, and while those years seemed compelling enough to me at the time, you would presumably not be reading a narrative entitled Memoirs of a Securities Analyst. Anyway, right in the middle of my rather ordinary way through life, a minor but altogether extraordinary scientific mishap rendered a small spherical chunk of New Jersey utterly invisible. As chance would have it, I was at the critical moment included in that spherical chunk. I, together with my immediate surroundings, was instantly transformed. Just as in a petrified fossil, the structure of the original organism is exactly reduplicated as an arrangement of mineral particles, so my body was exactly reduplicated as a living structure of minute units of energy. It functions very much as before, with, as far as I've been able to determine, only minor differences. But you cannot see it at all.
Was that ever a fantasy of yours, to be invisible?
I don't remember it. It must have been. I spent 5 years of my life working on it, but I don't remember it.
You don't remember
having been a fantasy as a child.
I think everybody at one time or another has thought about being invisible, whether it be out of embarrassment or, oh, I don't know, to have access to something that you normally wouldn't have. But even though it wasn't a fantasy of yours, it intrigued you enough to write a book based on it.
Yes, I think that when I was looking for something to use as the in this book, having abandoned my business career and in order to try to become a writer, the image came into my mind of a woman embracing a completely invisible man, and the image was so ridiculous and appealing at the same time that I was sure that I had a good idea.
And so then you carried it forward. I mean, you almost had to define invisibility.
The invisibility, of course, it turns out to be a wonderful driving mechanism, both for the plot and the character. For people who haven't read the book, and I'm afraid there must be still a very large number of them out there, and this man, having become immediately invisible, is... government agents want to get their hands on him because, among other things, they think he'd make a splendid laboratory animal, which he certainly would. And he understandably wants to get away from him. And the rest of the plot consists of this paranoid chase. He makes his way to New York City, where he, completely isolated but in the midst of humanity, leads this kind of Robinson Crusoe-like existence where he can't let anyone know he's there, and he has to find out how to provide for himself all his basic needs, clothing and food, and above all, some kind of human companionship, which for most of the book he can really only get over the telephone.
But if he is invisible, how does anyone know he's there?
Well, one of the invisibility, of course, isn't a terribly original idea, I have to say, but invisibility for this hero, instead of being a magical power which enables him to escape all the normal constraints of everyday life, turns out to make everyday life far more difficult. He has to constantly be watching not only for the people pursuing him, but just for random vehicles or joggers or people on roller skates.
Because they would run into him.
Crash into him from any direction because they can't see him.
It's so curious that you've chosen to make invisibility not a magical power, not an asset. It becomes almost an affliction. For example, we're used to Topper, our blithe spirit, and these people can walk through walls and they can do anything they want, but he is really just a human being that if you were to punch him, you would hurt him, even though you couldn't see him.
Yes, you give up some of the fun of invisibility. On the other hand, you gain the a stronger plot, and also, I think, a more compelling metaphor, probably.
It's an interesting metaphor, because he's almost invisible before he becomes invisible. He is, part of the great gray they that goes to work every day at 9 and comes home every day at 5. And I don't ever think he's missed. Even after he becomes invisible, he's not even missed.
I guess one of the most melancholy things for him is that he's at first excited, like anyone thinking about invisibility, probably at the opportunity of hearing his friends talk about him being the fly on the wall. But then he discovers that he's really not such a terribly important part of anyone's life, and the kind of casual offhand judgments that people make about other people when they don't think they're going to come back really overwhelm him and cut him off even more from his life up to that point.
Mm. But he does function. He manages to stay alive by oh, going into empty apartments and trying to live there for a while, and by going to men's clubs and trying to live there for a while. But the most interesting thing is, given our society the way that it is, by phone. He still has a voice, he can pick up a phone, and he establishes a whole other identity, and not just an identity, but one that becomes rather wealthy as well.
Yes, he is the ultimate inside trader. And he finds that nowadays when everything is really a kind of electronic bookkeeping entity in some data bank, he can have bank accounts and brokerage accounts and charge accounts and order everything over the phone, and he gradually puts together an almost complete existence for himself.
He does also manage to have a lover. You said you started with the image of a woman embracing an invisible man, and he does eventually have a lover. Interestingly enough, it's someone whom he has been standing next to at a party, and she begins to talk about how she believes in ghosts.
Yes, the irony for him is that his relationship with this woman, and she's the only person who knows of his existence besides the people who are pursuing him, but his relationship with her is made possible by her superstitiousness, which is a quality for which he has he's quite a lot of contempt. He thinks himself as a terribly rational person, and the relationship almost comes apart because of this.
It took you 5 years to write this book. Awful long time.
Working, well, I tell myself I was working about half time. Probably would have taken me 5 years anyway.
Wasn't it fun for you, though?
This book is tremendous fun to write, and I think that's one of the things that drew me to the premise. There are all kinds of formulaic scenes, whether it's his relationship with a girl or just walking through a circular door, that it's fun for a writer to solve.
Is it difficult for you to talk about this book? I mean, it's after the fact. You've lived with it for 5 years. Do you find it hard to talk about it?
Well, it's hard in several ways. One, of course, is that after living with it for 5 years and knowing it almost by heart by the time I was done, I really was tremendously sick of it by the end. But also, I think it's generally hard to talk about fiction because you've put so much work into realizing the plot and the characters in a certain way that you're unhappy summarizing anything or restating it in any way.
Mm. Are you writing now?
Yes.
A sequel, Son of Invisible Man?
No, not a sequel. There were no more Invisible Man. I think I've chewed all the flavor out of that premise.
A new premise. Can we ask you about it?
Well, I couldn't say anything sensible. I'll be grateful if you let me escape that question soon.
Okay, then better not to say anything at all. H.F. Saint, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
H.F. Saint is the author of Memoirs of an Invisible Man, published by Athenaeum. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Leanne.
What stories are you following today?
Well, in the Persian Gulf today, oil tankers and the U.S. flagships that are accompanying them are proceeding laboriously on their way to Kuwait, stopping and starting to carry out minesweeping operations. In South Africa, the biggest strike in that nation's history. 200,000 gold and coal miners have walked off the job. We'll have a report on that and its impact on the South African economy. Also from Paris, we'll be talking to Alice Furlow, who tells us about the trials and tribulations of being an American in Paris during the summer. Distant relatives and people she's barely met descend upon her.
Thanks, Renee. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio.
Thank you.
According to the A.C. Nielsen Company, the average American household has a TV set on 7 hours a day, and cable television is one of the reasons. Our guest television critic, David Mark, has these thoughts on some of the most popular cable fare today.
The suburban family sitcoms of the late 50s, which were once thought to be commercially obsolete chestnuts from the black and white era, are enjoying spirited revival on cable TV these days. The Christian Broadcasting Network is offering such born-again entertainment as Father Knows Best and Hazel to its international satellite audience. Nickelodeon now features reruns of Donna Reed and My Three Sons on its new primetime schedule aimed at middle-aged TV lifers. Ted Turner, not satisfied with the 234 original Leave It to Beaver episodes that he already airs on his Atlanta superstation, produces the new Leave It to Beaver, in which a graying Wally and a bloated Beaver are still, after 30 years, the unwitting victims of an unrecalcitrant Eddie Haskell. On cable as elsewhere, it's hip to be square. Audience affection for these and other pre-Gulf of Tonkin sitcoms might be attributed to a romantic yearning for stable, divorce-free, two-parent households, in which father ventures out into the world to hunt for a paycheck, while mother stays at home enforcing physical and spiritual cleanliness. Drugless and immune to sexually transmitted diseases, the suburb of sitcom dreams is devoid of dangerous strangers, public transportation, economic hardship, and other anxiety-producing modern phenomena. The individually tended but uniformly trimmed lawns of curving, tree-lined streets bespeak the values of a homogeneous folk community where a common moral will ensures a peaceful, prosperous destiny. There isn't a Japanese product in the house. Father Knows Best epitomizes these benevolent Aryan melodramas. The show transports the viewer to a kind of Eisenhower-Walden where adolescent moral ambiguity is ritualistically trotted out and proven to be no match for the paternal instincts of a rational white breadwinner. Everyone in Springfield, USA, is so white and so Protestant that even the Anderson seemingly Hispanic gardener goes by the name of Frank Smith. The chain of command within the family is equally clear. Father, as the show's title indicates, retains biblical prerogative. His wife Margaret, unlike the restless Lucy Ricardo or the tough-minded Alice Cramden, never seriously contests male authority, not even for comic purposes. Betty, the oldest Anderson child, is impossibly high-strung. It is not unusual to find her convulsed in tears because some boy at school has called her plain. Son Bud tends to err on the side of male enthusiasm, but his impulsive plans to go to sea or join the carnival are thwarted by father without so much as a raised voice. A simple reminder of the family's genetic college-bound destiny will do. Kathy, the youngest, is a prepubescent tomboy whose temporarily non-feminine behavior is the source of much family humor. With the spread of color TV in the 60s, Father Knows Best became increasingly hard to find. Industry wisdom held that newly equipped color families would be reluctant to tune in black and white shows. By the 80s, however, the novelty of color had faded, and the ideological time was ripe for revival. If the style of Father Knows Best seems hopelessly outdated, the form of role modeling it pioneered survives today in shows such as Cosby and Growing Pains, sitcoms that are likely to stimulate similar commentary in the 21st century, should cable TV or the world last that long.
David Mark teaches at Brandeis University. He's the author of Demographic Vistas, Television in American Culture, and is a frequent contributor to the Village Voice. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with artist Jenny Holzer, whose controversial electronic signs have lit up Broadway, banks, airports, and art galleries. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will take us back to Elvis Presley's first recording session. There, country music met the blues and produced many of the rock rhythms we hear today. And book critic John Leonard will review Bruce Duffy's novel, The World as I Found It. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to thank the people who make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests while they're in Philadelphia are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of the city's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is our production assistant, with additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Joyce Lieberman is our engineer, and Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.